sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Lynn Sharon Schwartz, award-winning author about her new book, Truth Telling. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Two Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Two Jewish is paid for by Two Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom and Chag Sameach and Moadim L'Simcha. We have completed the High Holy Days, so naturally the Jewish calendar launches us immediately into another major festival, Sukkot. This is a time of great joy for Jews. We're celebrating the Feast of Tabernacles, Sukkot. Actually, my favorite Jewish festival, in part because it isn't Yom Kippur. No, in fact, I love Sukkot because of the outdoor quality, the emphasis on family, friends, guests, and enjoying life, and its central theme of gratitude, which underlies much of what is best about religion in general and Judaism in specific. Sukkot is the 8-day-long harvest festival commemorating a holiday that's one of the truly ancient ones in our very complicated Jewish calendar. In biblical times, Sukkot, also called Sukkot, was referred to as Hechag, the holiday, as though it were literally the only one, and likely it was the most observed of all the festivals ordained in the Torah. Sukkot's the Jewish harvest festival during which we build tabernacles, little huts outside of the house. We decorate them with fruits and vegetables in which we eat and even sleep over the course of the holiday. It's called Zman Simchatenu, the time of our joy, filled with food, friends, and music, as well as rituals that pay tribute to our reliance upon God for the many good things in our lives. It's kind of the Jewish Thanksgiving, and in fact, the American holiday of Thanksgiving was based by the Puritan fathers on the biblical Feast of Tabernacles, or Feast of Booths, established in the Torah. It was particularly important for our ancestors, whose whole lives were connected to agricultural production, farming, herding, tending orchards and vineyards. A good harvest meant a healthy, safe winter. It was something for which to be truly grateful. The reason Sukkot was the most observed of all ancient festivals was likely because it came at the right time of year. While the Torah specifies 3 separate pilgrimage festivals in which the ancient Israelites traveled to Jerusalem to make offerings to God, Passover in the spring, Shavuot, the Feast of Weeks in early summer, and Sukkot in the autumn, there must have been major challenges to farmers inherent on walking to Jerusalem for the first 2 of these. Springtime, when Pesach occurs, is a time of planting, weeding, fertilizing, doing all the hard work that eventually results in a good crop. Early summer, when Shavuot falls, is the time of the first fruits and the early barley crop, which must be harvested. But there are many other crops still growing that need to be tended in the diverse Mediterranean agriculture of Israel. But Sukkot comes in the fall. All the yields are complete, the harvest is in, it's a time of plenty, and a much easier time to take a week to travel to the capital and celebrate. Sukkot must have been when the greatest crowds arrived, bringing their agricultural bounty to Jerusalem, making sacrificial offerings, but enjoying feasts every night of the festival. The temporary huts they erected, the Sukkot they built, would have been much like the huts that they used when they stayed in the fields near the crops they were harvesting. It was a time of joy and celebration, of food and drink and great conviviality. And it still is. Sukkot's the time when you are commanded to invite guests to your own sukkah, which reflects on the very structure of that temporary building, open on at least one side, so the visitors see immediately they are welcome. In addition to the ritual commandments of sitting in the sukkah and waving the lulav and etrog, the 4 species with which we celebrate the festival, palm, willow, myrtle, and citron, symbolizing the agricultural nature of the holiday, we also complete a great commandment of hachnasat orchim, welcoming guests. Although this year, while we're outside, they should be masked and socially distanced, as appropriate for these pandemic times. Even luminaries from the Jewish pastor invited, called Ushbizin, such as Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, everyone is supposed to enjoy Sukkot, even our past greats. There's a lovely little Yiddish tune about a sukkah called Asukkala by the oddly named duo of Suki and Ding.
Asukkala, a kleine, vom Breitalach gemeine, hab ich mir Asukkala gemacht, badektem da. Bezeles khan zit sich mir in sikle bana padektem da mit bezeles khan zit sich mir in sikle bana. In the cold, durch die Spalten, in die lächerlich sei löschen sich viel. Es ist mir achidisch, ich mach mir kidisch, in die lächerlich. Sei brennen ganz still. Es ist mir für dich, wie ich mach mir kiddisch. In die Lächterle, sei brennen ganz still. Sei nicht kanal, in hab nicht. Soll dir die Sicke nicht sein Bang. Es ist schon gut, bald 2000 Jahre. In die Sicke sie steigt noch ganz lang. Es ist schon gut,
That was the pretty little song Asukkala for the holiday of booths, Sukkot, this week. By the way, in Europe, there were homes actually built with a room with a retractable roof that could be turned into a kind of interior sukkah for the festival, an inside-the-house hut. By Jewish law, sukkah cannot have more than 2 permanent walls, so these interior sukkahs made some accommodation by constructing extra walls inside. It speaks to the level of commitment to this holiday and to being Jewishly observant that whole homes were designed with a sukkah, used just 8 days a year, in mind. When we return in a moment here on Too Jewish, our guest, the fine author Lynn Sharon Schwartz, will share how her new book, Truth-Telling, evolved and just how she feels about writing short stories. Find out when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in the Catalina foothills in northwest Tucson, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this fall. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vital community, striving every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson of the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Sukkot's here now, and we are celebrating online, but you can join us for limited in-person attendance, masked, blended Shabbat services if you call 520-276-5675 in advance and request attendance. And of course, on Facebook Live, everybody can come on our Facebook page. Beit Simcha Synagogue is located at 2270 West Ina Road, just west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall property. Not in the mall, but in our own building. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone in normal times in these days of coronavirus tsoras. Join us Friday night on our Facebook Live page for Shabbat evening celebration services at 6:30 p.m. Saturday morning, Shabbat services are at 10 a.m., all with me leading them. Our Facebook page is BEITSIMCHA Tucson, Beit Simcha Tucson, and we'll hold our services with full music by virtual experience. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are on Zoom, and some are also blended in person. You can access those by emailing me at rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org or going to our website. Synagogues at 2270 West Ina Road, west of La Cholla on the north side of Ina, entrance to the Foothills Mall property. And for now, we are a fully functioning, mostly virtual congregation on Facebook and Zoom. Email me at rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org for more information. You can also learn about Beit Simcha by going to our website. You can attend services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes program, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation and high school programs, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses. Those are taught on Zoom, and of course, all of our services on Facebook. Go to www.beitsimchatucson.org, BEITSIMCHA Tucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the newest and fastest-growing Jewish synagogue community in southern Arizona in its exciting beginning years. We are delighted to welcome the two Jewish, Lynn Sharon Schwartz, who is highly accomplished author and the author of a new and quite wonderful book of interconnected stories called Truth Telling. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Thank you very much. Good morning.
So I have to say, the first story in this collection is stunning. Tell us a little bit about the characters, because they are interwoven from earlier books too, right?
That's right. These characters... let's see, I think they're Carolyn and Ivan, is that right?
So the first story is truth-telling, and it's about the...
It's about the older couple who were... All the bad things they did, and
that's
all
right.
The lies they've been told. That's right. Actually, these characters are not from another book. Somewhere else, if we get to it, there's another story where I have characters named Carolyn and Ivan, and I have been with them since, the 1980s when I wrote a novel about them. I wrote stories about them, and the editor told me to make a novel, so I did. And then sometimes I return to them, but maybe we'll get to that later. Anyway, these characters, they're pretty old. I don't specify, but they're still, in their right minds, and they can enjoy life. And it's the wife's idea that why not, now that most of it is past and we're not about to get a divorce, because people don't do that at this point, but so what's the point of that? Why don't we tell some truths and find out things we never knew before? And the husband is not very eager to do this, but she kind of pushes it, and then little by little, they shock each other with some of the things they've done.
The betrayals, and I mean, it's really quite amazing.
Yeah, it doesn't all involve adultery and affairs. There's a little bit of that, but there are other things. I mean, there are worse things or equal things. She thinks that he criticizes how he managed to get promoted in his law firm, and there are other things like that. Nothing really terrible, nothing you would go to jail for, but all the little peccadilloes that if we think about our lives, we are guilty of. And that's one reason I wrote the story, to make people start thinking, well, you know, they sound pretty bad, but wait a minute, did I ever do anything like that? Well, maybe I did. So they stand in for all of us.
All of the ways, all of the small betrayals and, well, the falsehoods on which our lives depend.
Yeah, the secrets. I think it's impossible to get through life without some secrets. I mean, you can't just be an open book, especially if you want to maintain all your relationships and be close with your loved ones. There are some things that it's better to just keep to yourself.
We will come back to talk about the book Truth Telling and Truth in Writing with Lynn Sharon Schwartz when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish. Do you know someone who personally made a major difference for the whole Jewish people? An individual who's done important work for Klal Yisrael and deserves to be highly recognized for that effort. As president of the Cohen Memorial Foundation, I'm grateful that the modest cash awards we started more than 10 years ago have grown into a substantial amount of unrestricted funds given to winners, with the help of donors like many of you. The foundation, named for my grandparents, Rabbi Samuel S. Cohen and Irma Cohen, makes these awards for important service to Klal Yisrael, the entire Jewish people. That service can be in one of four activities: unity, education, creative arts, or rescue. Past Cohen Award recipients are remarkable people who've done outstanding work. If you know someone who qualifies for a Cohen Foundation Award, please go to CohenAward.com, CohenAward.com, and fill out the simple nomination form. That website is CohenAward.com. Nominate an individual or donate yourself. Do it for the whole Jewish people. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit our website, twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcast, top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine, with 100,000 downloads. My favorite story about building a sukkah, the temporary tabernacle we put up in our backyards, is a reminder of the booths our ancestors built at harvest time, and as a further reminder of the 40 years of wandering they did in the wilderness of Sinai, between leaving Egyptian slavery and arriving in the Promised Land. Anyway, my favorite story goes like this. It involves my grandfather on my mom's side, my Zadie Lou, who was, well, very famous for never throwing anything out, ever. When he and my Bubby Dora moved to California in 1948 or so, he took along a multitude of glass jars filled with screws, bolts, nuts, and washers. And he took the chains you need to attach storm windows for the winter, not perhaps realizing storm windows are not a staple of life in Los Angeles. Anyway, one year my Zadie Lou and my dad were putting up the sukkah in the backyard. Neither one was a precise builder, but they both worked with great enthusiasm. They had the sukkah pretty much built out of old plywood, scraps of 2x4s, leftover wooden crates, and so on. Wasn't much to see, but they were very proud of it and were stepping back to admire it when they noticed it was not just a tabernacle, but a lean-to, and it was leaning all right, way over to the left. My Zadie and my dad stood back, sweating, and looked at the sloping sukkah. "Well, if we had some way to pull it back to the right, maybe it would be okay for sukkahs," my dad suggested. "We could throw something over the tree and pull it straight." My Zadie Lou said, "I've got just the thing in the garage." He went in, rummaged around in the garage, full of those glass jars, screws, bolts, and washers, and found just what he needed. The chains from the New Jersey storm windows that had traveled 3,000 miles to California. So my Zadie Lou and my dad slung the big chains over a branch of the tree, attached it to the right side of the sukkah, and then my dad pulled on it, and the sukkah lurched over to the right, just a little too far to be called straight. "Oi," Zadie said, "maybe if we throw the other chain over the left side from the sukkah, we could straighten it that way." And so a second storm window chain went over the tree and around the left side of the sukkah. My Zadie Lou pulled on that chain. The sukkah pulled back left, again a little too far to be centered. My dad pulled on his window chain, the makeshift sukkah moved right, my Zadie Lou pulled on the other window chain and the sukkah moved back, and so on as they tried to even out their great tabernacle in the wilderness. Back and forth went this sukkah seesaw. Meanwhile, my mom's mother, Bubby Dora, had come outside to watch the proceedings. Quietly she stood, wiping her hands on her apron, viewing the spectacle. Finally, she spoke in Yiddish. Sholem Aleichem is gestorben vor der Zeit. The great Yiddish humorist Sholem Aleichem died too young. He should only have lived to see this. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
And Chag Sameach.
Also to you.
Good and a happy and a joyful Sukkot, even in this very strange world of pandemics. We started talking last week about Montenegro and the complexity of even Montenegrin identity, Eastern Orthodox on one side, Roman Catholic on the coast. The Jewish community. Where did the Jews come from originally?
Well, probably the earliest Jews in Montenegro came with the Greeks, who built coastal towns for trade. And, you know, at one point, every major port in the Mediterranean had some Jewish community in it, even before the destruction of the Second Temple during Roman times. And these communities on the Montenegrin coast had Jewish communities even earlier under the Greek Empire. But these communities waxed and waned. There was no sense of permanence.
They were
nor
trading,
was there,
trading entrepôts, really, for the
right.
Jews.
Nor was there any sense of continuity, like we are chapter two of the Jewish history here. It was like every time they started over. In more recent times, let's say after the Holocaust and World War II and all those horrors, there was a country called the Socialist Federated Republic of Yugoslavia, which comprised several different republics and some special autonomous regions. Those republics were, I'm going to oversimplify and rush through this part a little bit, but Montenegro and Macedonia in the far south, Croatia, Bosnia in the middle, Serbia, the rest of Croatia, the part that's not known as Dalmatia, and Slovenia in the north. There were also two autonomous regions, one of which is now a country called Kosovo, whose independence is recognized by much of the world, but not all of it. And the other was an autonomous region between Belgrade and the Hungarian border called Vojvodina. And the Vojvodina actually began directly across the river from Belgrade in what's now a suburb of Belgrade called Zemun, which was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire.
And this is the simplified version, Tom.
Yeah, this is the simplified version.
Oh, my gosh.
Okay. So, long story short, when I used to go to Yugoslavia for the World Union of Jewish Students in the 1970s, while Tito was still alive, the Federation of all the separate Jewish communities of Yugoslavia was run by an Ashkenazic Jew named Ladislav Kadelberg. And Mr. Kadelberg frequently told me, all the republics have Jews except for Montenegro. There are no Jews there. Don't bother going there. So I took that at face value and assumed that was the story. And none of my Jewish friends in the entire country ever referred to any friends or family from Montenegro. And then the former Yugoslavia broke up. And here's where the story starts to get interesting.
And we will pick that up next week.
I look forward to it.
Thanks so much, Tom. I'm glad this is the simplified version. Chag Sameach. It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie New, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. This, the classic Sukkot joke. So a guy builds a sukkah on his fire escape in New York City. The landlord is irate and sues him and asks the judge to force the tenant to remove the illegal structure. In court, the judge agrees with the landlord. I understand you have no permit for this unauthorized structure. That's true, Your Honor, says the Jewish guy, but it's a religious requirement. That may very well be true, but the tabernacle structure must go, declares Judge Feldman. I order you to remove it within 10 days. Next case. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well and take down that sukkah at least within 8 or 10 days. And now a word of Torah. This Shabbat, we read the special Torah reading for the festival of Shmini Atzeret, the eighth day of Sukkot, technically a separate holiday in its own right. Sukkot is an agricultural festival rich in ritual, and the observances for Shmini Atzeret, including chanting Hallel, the special festival service of praise, reciting Yisker memorial prayers for the dead, and the unique Tfilat Geshem, the blessing for rain, The prayer for rain is chanted to an unusual and beautiful melody that's only used one other time in the year on the festival of Pesach, Passover. We pray for dew, tal, connecting us to the natural world and God's creation and control of it through prayer and song. The Torah reading on Shabbat morning of Shemini Atzeret is shared with Passover and Shavuot, and it includes the rites of the pilgrimage festivals in biblical times. Then, Saturday night, on the holiday of Simchat Torah that completes the complex fall holiday cycle, we will finish the Torah with the final portion of Deuteronomy, including the death of Moses, and begin again to read the Torah by chanting the opening passages of Genesis and the gorgeous narrative of the creation of the universe. It's a period of abundance in both harvest foods and Torah readings. But there's also one special additional reading we include on this festival that's not from the Torah, but instead the later stages of the Bible, the Ketuvim or writings, Ecclesiastes, Kohelet. The beautiful biblical book chanted on Shabbat Sukkot or Shemini Atzeret is perhaps the single most beautiful piece of literature in all history. Succinct, poetic, gorgeous, wise. It includes famous phrases that have become part of our lexicon, including the sun also rises. There's nothing new under the sun. All rivers run to the sea, and the sea is not full. For everything there is a time and a season for every purpose under heaven. And of course, the earth returns to the dust that it was, but the spirit returns to God who gave it. The conclusion of Ecclesiastes is simple but powerful. After a poetic search of wisdom and folly, a survey of what the world has to offer, the author concludes, "The conclusion of the matter all having been heard is to revere God, keep the mitzvot, for that makes the complete human being." As the autumn approaches, Kohelet reminds us that so much of what we do is vanity. Vanity of vanity, all is vanity, the book begins, after all, and compels us to realize God is our true source of meaning and beauty. At this joyous time of year, it is a sobering but truly magnificent reminder of all that really matters. Even, perhaps especially, at seasons of joy and times of gladness, we need to remember our greatest success comes from our own actions. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, Lynn Sharon Schwartz, shares the connections between her Judaism and her writing. We'll be back on To Jewish in just a moment.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Israel reported record numbers of confirmed cases of the coronavirus, 9,000 in one day in a 24-hour period last week. Its current death rate on a per capita basis is now actually higher than the U.S. The over 9,000 confirmed infections reported represent a 14% positivity rate in one day. Israel's had a total of about 1,600 deaths from the novel coronavirus, a tiny fraction of the 200,000 American deaths from COVID-19. But Israel, of course, has a much smaller population. Meanwhile, the Knesset cabinet voted to further extend the current full lockdown meant to prevent the spread of the deadly virus. The Israeli cabinet also approved fining those caught in a sukkah that is not their own. Israel's embattled coronavirus czar, Dr. Roni Gamzu, said that 40% of the verified coronavirus cases in Israel are from the Haredi ultra-Orthodox community, although they make up only about 8% of the population. The large number of cases discovered last week was fallout from the number of tests performed on Yom Kippur itself. Meanwhile, reports that sukkahs with the capacity to hold hundreds of people were still being constructed in Jerusalem, sparking fears of a continued spike in virus cases in the Haredi ultra-Orthodox community. The rabbinic leadership of the Sephardic Orthodox Shas Party called for prayer services to be held outdoors only to prevent the spread of coronavirus. It marked the first time the Shas Council of Torah Sages has ordered the closure of all synagogues since the start of the pandemic. The statement calls on Shas followers to observe all government health orders and said that anyone who does not follow could become a potential murderer. Prayer services should not be held at all indoors. It called for services to be shortened when possible and for Sukkot and Simchat Torah to be observed at home with only the nuclear family. It offered instructions for Simchat Torah, including not dancing in hakafot in the circles, not handing the Torah scrolls from one person to another. The Torah scroll should also not be kissed, said the Shas rabbis. Meanwhile, 17 flights returning to Israel from Ukraine and Belarus carrying passengers who observed an annual Bratslava Hasidic Rosh Hashanah pilgrimage in Uman brought back someone with a confirmed case of the coronavirus, according to Israeli Health Ministry officials. Some of the infected, even those displaying symptoms, refused to be tested before boarding. And the Committee of University Heads in Israel announced the academic year for colleges and universities will begin with online remote learning only, citing the continued rise in cases of coronavirus and the second lockdown that will likely extend past the start of the academic year. As soon as the morbidity situation allows it, we will return to learning in an outline that combines classroom studies in parallel with online learning, the committee said. In New York, in unsavory news, Seagram heiress Claire Bronfman was sentenced to more than 6 years in prison for her involvement in a self-help organization that has been accused of being a sex cult. Bronfman, 41 years old, was sentenced in Brooklyn Federal Court for assisting the NXIVM, I'm not even sure how to say it, group. She was not a member, but was estimated to have spent at least $116 million to help that group. She pled guilty in April 2019 to harboring an undocumented immigrant for financial gain, committing credit card fraud on behalf of Keith Rainier, NXIVM's leader. Prosecutors say some NXIVM members were forced to have sex with Rainier and branded with his initials. Claire Bronfman was given a longer sentence than the 5 years requested by prosecutors and fined $500,000. I'm troubled by evidence suggesting Ms. Bronfman repeatedly and consistently leveraged her wealth and social status as a means of intimidating, controlling, and punishing NXIVM's enemies, said the judge. Bronfman and five others, including Rainier, were indicted in March 2018. Rainier was found guilty of sex trafficking, forced labor, and other felonies during a trial last year. Claire Bronfman's late father, Edgar Bronfman Sr., was scion and longtime head of the Seagram's Company, one point the largest distiller of alcoholic beverages in the world. Bronfman was president of the World Jewish Congress for many years and a major supporter of an array of Jewish causes, including the Jewish Telegraphic Agency and its partner site, My Jewish Learning, which Bronfman founded in 2003. He died in 2013 at the age of 84.
I am woman, hear me roar. In numbers too big to ignore, and I know too much to go back and pretend. 'Cause I've heard it all before, and I've been down there on the floor. No one's ever gonna keep me down again.
I learn something new every day. When singer Helen Reddy died last week, I learned she was Jewish, having converted before marrying her manager Jeff Wald, before she became a huge star of the 1970s and a feminist icon of the era. Born in Melbourne, Australia, performer from the age of four, her first hit was a version of I Don't Know How to Love Him from the Broadway rock musical Jesus Christ Superstar. I Am Woman reached the top of the Billboard's charts at the end of 1972, which led to Helen Reddy's Grammy for Best Female Pop Vocal Performance. 5 years later, she starred in the Disney children's film Pete's Dragon. In 2002, Helen Reddy retired from show business, went back to Australia to work as a practicing hypnotherapist and motivational speaker. She made a brief comeback in 2012, performing in several concerts and saying I Am Woman in 2017 at the Los Angeles Women's March. In December 2000, when she released her album titled The Best Christmas Ever, Reddy said she honored her Judaism by making sure that none of the songs mentioned Jesus. Well, they didn't. Okay. She passed away last week from the effects of dementia at the young age of 78. Baruch Dayan Emet. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish the highly accomplished and awarded author, Lynn Sharon Schwartz, talking about her new book, Truth Telling. Authors who are creating novels and short stories are making it up, aren't they? So can you tell us about how one tells truth while inventing fiction? And in your new group of stories, you kind of merge into some really fantastic travels in, I mean, it becomes less, it's a little bit of hyper-realism. I'm not sure what to call it exactly.
Yeah, it does go into the surreal. I mean, there are things that could not happen, especially that there's the one, what is it called, Pickup. where a woman is standing in front of a hotel and a man drives by in a car. She's very worried about her father. She's there. She's in this strange city, I think it's Chicago, because he's in a hospital. And she looks at the car, who seems to be waiting. Which seems to be waiting for a passenger. And she suddenly thinks, "What would happen if I got in?" And you know, it's really quite a risk. And suddenly, she's whisked away. And he says he's been expecting her, and she's taken to a concert where she's expected to play the piano. It's just kind of wild.
It is wild.
I think when we're in an extreme situation, like she's in a strange place, not knowing what or how her father will survive, fantasy becomes so real. It doesn't really happen. I mean, I don't expect people to believe that these things happened, but they're another kind of truth. They're the imaginative truth that we don't often admit. There's a woman in another story. I can't remember the name, but she has no patience with her baby because she can't stand the loud crying, and she just gives her to her mother. Now, this is, of course, we would consider it reprehensible. I do, but it's like it's the fantasies we have. You know, I don't know if you have any babies, but
I did along the way.
You did.
Not anymore, but yeah.
Oh, when you get frustrated with children, and you know what you have to do for them, you suddenly think, wouldn't it be nice if I could just give them to somebody? Not forever.
No, just for a while. Yeah, just get rid of them for a little while. Have my life back a little bit.
Yes. Yeah, so these are truths that are secret truths, truths of the imagination.
There are lots of different ways of writing. You've published novels, short stories, poetry. What do you like best?
Oh, I think I like short stories best, which is what these are in truth-telling. I've written a lot of novels, about 8 novels, and they're nice. I mean, of course, they're more than nice, but I like to do them because it's a big thing, and you kind of, you know what you're going to be doing for the next 3 years when you go to your desk. You don't have to worry about what will I do today. So, but I really like, there's something about the short story in its economy and the flexibility of it. I don't think I would take the kind of liberties in a novel, the kind of surreal liberties that I take with these stories, because it's very short. However weird it gets, it's over, and that's all. But in a novel, if you get very weird, you have to carry through.
Or go back and fix it and change it.
Yes, yes. I like to write essays, and...
Also for their brevity, or just do you like to write essays?
I like to write them for... where I can speak in my own voice. I don't take advantage of short stories and novels to shoot off my opinions and, you know, what I think about things. They're stories, they're fiction, and I'm trying to, I hate this expression, rather than express myself, which I always tell students not to use, rather than express myself, I'm trying to build a structure, like a piece of sculpture that fits together, and when you look at it, it looks... You see all the joints, and you know that it fits. But in an essay, I really do want to say what I think. You know, sometimes we all want to take that liberty and say what we think. In an essay, I can. And also, I can be funny. I like to write funny. I just wrote an essay about my driving. I have always been a very anxious driver. I won't go into why. But I had a father who was... who is a wild man on the road, and I wanted to be like him, but I just didn't have the nerve. So I wrote about all my driving exploits and about the cars that my husband and I had, and they each had a name and what they did, and I personified them. So it was fun at the same time as it was dealing with an issue that has troubled me. You know, now I'm old, and I really don't drive anymore. I don't want to drive. I mean, when you're my age, you don't have to drive. You know, you just... people know you're old, but you know, when you're 40 or 50 and you just don't want to drive, they kind of look at you, what's wrong with you? So I would drive with my heart in my throat, but now I'm exempt from all that.
Mazel tov. I think that's a good thing.
Thank you. I also I have three books of poetry. I like to write poetry, but I, you know, there are real and great poets living among us. I'm trying to remember some, like Seamus Heaney, who is dead now.
Yes, unbelievable.
Yeah. Who's the other, the one with the G, I'm sorry. But there are some wonderful poets.
Billy Collins, I mean, I think of, there's a lot of great poets out.
Oh, Billy Collins, yes, this is very good. But I'm not an ambitious poet. I'm an ambitious fiction writer. I mean, I know what I'm doing, and I want to do the best I can, and I want it to be set up, you know, judged against the best. But with poetry, I just don't have that. I mean, I can write some, you know, very able, pleasant, amusing, and even, you know, lyrical poems. But I'm not doing it to show how well I can do it. I'm just doing it. This is a kind of expression. And that's where I have some Jewish things. I was going to ask you, when I first got this invitation, which I'm happy to have, what is...
A quick story. This is our origin story, our Ur story, or Breshit, if you will. We were starting the show, and I'd been talking about it very loosely, and somebody said, okay, you're starting in August. I said, I'm starting what in August? I said, you're starting a show. So we had to think of a name. And we debated a variety of names, and we thought about Deli Home Companion, but we figured we'd get sued. And then we tried All Jews Considered, and we thought we'd get sued for that too. And then, so the working title for a while was Shema Yisrael, which seemed like, you know, okay, that's a pretty good title. And everybody said, well, that's okay, it's a good title, but it's too Jewish. And then I thought, it is too Jewish. Exactly. And so I said, wait a minute, too Jewish. That's a good name. So that's how it happened.
Yeah, when I first got your invitation, I thought, well, I mean, how Jewish do I have to be to go in? Am I Jewish enough? Am I too Jewish or not Jewish?
Exactly.
But anyways, it's...
And that is sort of the American question, you know, how Jewish are we? So you mentioned you have some Jewish, sort of your Jewish identity emerges more in your poetry.
Yes, it does. I have some very nice poems about, if you'd like to hear them, I could read them.
I would love to hear one. That would be great.
Really? Okay. I don't want to sort of foist them on you, but I'm very fond of this. You know, I'm not I know you're a rabbi, but I'm old enough to do as I wish, right? So I'm not an observant Jew, I was brought up that way. My mother was pretty observant, except when she wanted to visit her mother on Saturdays and my father drove her. But so I was brought up by an observant Jew and an atheist. So I was caught in between. Now, let's see. Well, I don't want to keep you waiting here.
Oh, that's all right. We have, you know, Jews in America and actually around the world. We interview people from all over. Span the spectrum.
This poem is called Yiddish. Let me go to it.
Please.
Yeah, so my background is East European Jews, and that's what I grew up with in Brooklyn. But I'm very fond of this poem because of the names. You know, some names are... Is it, are the names in this one? Maybe it's not. Anyway, I'll find the other one. Yiddish. Only the old ones spoke it all the time and perfectly, like Esther with the upswept white-yellow hair, who scraped walnut shells from the afternoon's gossip off the oilcloth tabletop with a butter knife, and at the edge tipped them into her waiting palm. Yiddish, I thought, was something that happened to you as you aged, like pink wrinkled cheeks and yellow-white hair. I once saw it gleaming down her back at midnight as she stood at the top of the stairs in her flannel nightgown. The older you were, the better you spoke. It grew on you. My parents could speak it too, but only now and then, for secrets, and not with Esther's deep old world gargle. My older sister spoke it with a new world accent I trusted that would fade over the years. And I, still a child, though I understood their Yiddish, could utter just a few phrases that made people laugh. I didn't mind. I knew I'd improve with time. And when I was truly old, but straight-backed and beautiful like Esther, my voice would be hoarse, and would acquire the old world gargle, and from my tongue would flow a consummate Yiddish, a lifetime's worth of perfecting.
That's wonderful.
Thank you.
By the way, it doesn't happen like that.
No. I really thought that that was how it happened. You know, you had to be old.
Yeah, you had to be old to speak Yiddish well.
To have it flow.
Or to speak it at all.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's a beautiful poem. I love it.
You want to hear another? It's even better.
Yeah, let's have another. Let's have another.
All right, then you may have things you want to say.
I do have a couple of questions for you.
Okay. This is, well, you're a rabbi, so obviously you know the practice of naming new babies.
Naming after someone who has passed away in Ashkenazic tradition. Yeah, of course.
Okay, it's called So They Are Not Alone. My mother pitied the fate of her uncle Shmuel back in the old country, murdered before he could marry, no descendants, while his brothers and sisters, immigrants all, were frantically fruitful and multiplied. Whenever a member of the clan was pregnant, my mother reminded them of childless Shmuel. The name doesn't have to be Shmuel, she'd say. I know that sounds too foreign. Or even Samuel, just an S would do, so he's not all alone. Imagine them safe at last in the afterlife. The Alters and Avigdors, Beryls, Baruchs, and Mendels, Velvels and Zvis, surrounded by their namesakes. Just the one letter, the alien names. The Victors, Barrys, and Allens, and Marks. The Tonys, Bryans, and Brents, all of an age. And the beautiful names of the women, Yael and Rivka, Zissel, Malka, Batya, and Chaya, Dalit, and Shoshana. At their feet sit Roxanne and Betty, Zoe, Marianne, Heidi, Diane, Sophie, and Yvonne. There you will always find a ready welcome amid the chattering clusters of namesakes. Some few, like Great Uncle Shmuel, sit alone.
It's great.
Thank you. I feel such nostalgia for those names.
Yeah.
You know, which after, even when I was a child, you know, they became anglicized.
Of course.
And that's, you know, that's the way life goes. You can't stay in the past.
No, things change, but it's a beautiful poem. Sometimes poetry is best when it's reminiscent, isn't it?
Yes. Yes, it is.
I want to ask you about teaching a little bit. You've taught writing so many places at a high level. Can you really teach somebody how to write?
Well, that's a good question. when I started teaching, I had taught like a real teacher at Hunter College in New York, which is, you know, I taught freshman English. I wasn't very good at it, but I knew that I was teaching something that people needed to know. But then when I started getting asked to teach writing, I didn't believe that you could teach writing. I learned to write by reading. I was a reader, and
right.
I read and read,
right.
And then when it came time to write, I just had read a lot, and I used that. But over the years, since I've done it for, oh, God, over 20 years, I've come to respect it more, and it also is a living. Not much, but
no,
something.
A little bit of something. Maybe some health benefits.
Yeah, but I like my college. I teach right now. I teach at Bennington, which is a low residence program, which means you just go there for 2 weeks in the winter and the summer when there is not a COVID virus.
Yeah.
And you spend. It's very intense. You have classes all day and readings and stuff. And then you go home and you work on your writing and you send it to, we each get 5 students. And I go over their work very carefully. I go over it the way I go over my own, you know, really sort of with a fine-tooth comb, not with any principles of writing in mind particularly, but just line by line trying to make it better. So I think you can do that. You can make a mediocre writer into a better writer, and I've seen it happen, and that's okay. But you can't make someone into a great writer. I mean, there are so few of those, and so that's my final. You can improve people's writing, but if somebody doesn't have that, either the gift for language or I don't know. I can't call it inspiration.
If you don't have a voice and you don't have a way of conveying that voice, then maybe do something else.
Well, there's a... People talk about finding your voice. I've seen students do that. They get better and better.
Sure.
So I've become convinced from my own self-respect that you can do it. But I have never been to a writing program. I didn't even, when I was starting to write, I didn't even know there were writing programs. And, excuse me, I had little babies, and I couldn't go away to Iowa or someplace like that. It was just not possible. Later, I went there to teach, but I just started to write, and I learned, and I got better. But look, I guess I could name other professions or other arts. This is the way it's taught now, so there's no sense fighting it or rebelling against it. And they learn from each other, I think, more than from the teachers.
I want to thank Lynn Sharon Schwartz for a great visit here on Too Jewish. Her new book is called Truth Telling, and it's wonderful. You should get it. Where can people find out more about you?
Oh, about me? Well, I have a website. It's LynnSharonSchwartz.com, and that's one place. Where else do people find out?
They Google everybody. That's how they do it.
Yeah, well, on the website, it lists all my books, but probably if you just Google me, you'll get some information about my books.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. A good and a healthy year. Thank you again.
Thank you. Same to you, Rabbi Cohen, and I appreciate your inviting me.
My pleasure.
Okay, stay well.
You too. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball. Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Cohan. Our playout this morning comes from the late Shlomo Carlbach. For Sukkot, ufros aleinu sukkat shlomecha, spread over us the sukkah of your peace, compassion, and life. Join us next Sunday. Our guest on Too Jewish will be the editors of Bound in the Bond of Life. Pittsburgh writers reflect on the Tree of Life tragedy before the second anniversary of that terrible event. My friends, may you have a Chag Sameach, a holiday of Sukkot, of great joy. And a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of health and of peace. La 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 la.
sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.